If the world were like a Sleep Number mattress, everything would adapt for your comfort. Because as your life changes and your body changes, Sleep Number mattresses adapt and shift to give you personalized comfort night after night. And now everything's on sale during our Memorial Day event. Save up to $1,200 on mattresses for a limited time. To experience a whole new world of comfort, visit a Sleep Number store or go to sleepnumber.com. Sleep Number, to a good life's sleep.
Hello, and welcome to episode 246 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rotta, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Schools across the country have spent the past few years trying to solve a problem that feels obvious. Students are distracted by their phones. So the solution seems obvious, too. Ban them. And in many cases, these bans are working, at least in a narrow sense. Phones are out of sight, classrooms are quieter, teachers report fewer interruptions, but the results beyond that are less clear. Some of the largest studies so far suggest that while phone use drops, there isn't much measurable improvement in things like test scores, attendance, or even student well-being. That raises a bigger question about what problem we're actually trying to solve. We tend to think schools are competing with phones, but maybe that's not quite right. Perhaps schools are competing with a digital world that feels easier, more comfortable, and more rewarding than real life. And if that's the case, then simply taking phones away may not change much because students don't necessarily step out of that digital world. They just find other ways to stay in it. So, Rick, let's start here. If removing phones doesn't lead to better outcomes in the classroom, what does that tell us about the nature of this important problem?
Well, it tells us that the problem is more complex than many people have thought. I think that the phone bans are a good start, but they're one part of a larger cultural shift that we need to make. We have plenty of evidence now that with the arrival of both smartphones and social media, right around 2011, 2012, we see a sharp spike in depression, anxiety, stress among students and middle school and high school students. And then a few years later, we start seeing those effects in college students. And so there's a real strong correlation there. We can't think that, okay, once we implement a ban just on the phones in schools, we're going to see an immediate improvement in all those areas. What we're going to see is if that's part of a larger shift, I think we'll start seeing improvements. But it's not the only thing. It's like that's only a certain period of the day, and it's also only one of the ways in which students are accessing digital content. And if they're at schools, if they're spending a lot of time on Chromebooks and they're watching YouTube videos and that sort of thing, they're still going to have many of the negative effects that they would have had from cell phones.
You know, a few things that come to mind. First of all, although, like I said in the intro, I don't know if people expected immediate positive momentum when it comes to test scores and other performance measures. Those don't seem to have happened yet. But I think it is important to say that, like, teachers and the studies I've seen say they have not only a little better control over their classrooms because they're not constantly having to police for phones, but the teachers also seem happier. And I think that's like not nothing. I mean, that's important, I think, especially in a profession that is some places and some times having tough times attracting people.
Yeah, and if we look historically, like I don't know if teacher morale has ever been as low as it is right now, and it's largely because of all kinds of behavioral disruptions, and part of that is the phones in the classroom, And not being able to get students' attentions when they're distracted or otherwise occupied. And so you're right. We find as a result of this large study, and this is a huge study where they're looking at data from 41,000 schools. So it is a considerable finding that teachers are happier in the classroom and they think that they have more interaction, closer interaction with students.
And probably, and we'll get to some of the concerns here in a minute, but one of the other positive things I read, and this is a little more anecdotal, but there were reports that many schools saw an increase in the number of books being checked out from school libraries. And that kind of makes sense, right? I mean, kids might want to find something to occupy their time. And if they don't have TikTok, maybe they can discover what's on the shelves of their school libraries.
Yeah, and that raises a really interesting point, is that it's not just about banning the phones. It's about what are they replacing that time that they were spending on their phones, what are they replacing it with? So if they're replacing it with reading, for example, that's a really good sign, because what you're going to eventually see is a slowly increase attention spans, and that's going to lead over time to better test scores. It isn't a very quick turnaround. You don't go to reading a book, maybe a book every couple of weeks over the course of the school year, and immediately start improving your test scores. What happens is that your study habits maybe get a little bit better because you're able to focus better. Your attention span is greater. Gradually, you're able to recover some of those learning losses that had developed over time.
I know you've been thinking about this issue, well, actually for a while now. Was it 2 years ago or two Januaries ago? This was one of your picks for in our annual prediction show that schools would increase cell phone bans, and I think that certainly proved to be true. But you've also, I think more recently, compared this a little bit to the efforts that were popular, a couple decades ago in some cities where they were banning sugar-laden soft drinks. And that, like, seemed like a good idea, but, you know, as that played out, it didn't quite seem so simple.
Yeah, it's not so simple, because we can look, say, at increase in obesity and rates of diabetes that are related to sugary drinks, soft drinks. But just implementing a ban on the soft drinks won't do much if most of the people that are drinking those drinks replace it, say, with energy drinks, which are still very high in sugar, and fruit juice, which is high in sugar. If they replace it with those other things, you're not really accomplishing much. And this is one of the problems with a ban, and just measuring the ban itself and not measuring, like, has there been a complete change in behavior. What I would like to see next is a study not just of the schools that have implemented a ban, but what about the schools that have really focused on, for example, increasing a sense of belonging for students at the schools? What about the schools who implemented a ban and then really focus on helping their students join organizations, learn how to socialize again? Because one of the things we know is that there's been a real increase among this generation of students in social anxiety. That means it's harder for them to initiate social interaction, harder for them to know how to negotiate conflict. Just implementing a ban isn't going to help them learn those skills, right? They need to be taught these things in a way that previous students kind of learn them as a normal process of childhood growing up. This is a generation that needs to be taught deliberately how to develop those kinds of social skills.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. What I'm unsure about, though, and I mean, I'm curious your thought on this, is if you're, I don't know, 13, 14 years old, right? Sort of like maybe you have your first smartphone, and you can argue whether that's the right age or not, but, you know, that's kind of where we are. And you have this thing, And maybe you could use it kind of with impunity 1 year at school, and then you show up the next year and there's this ban in place, and you know, so you can't use it at school. Do you think that 13, 14 year olds might then think, wow, you know, maybe this isn't so good for me after all? I mean, I wonder if that ever crosses their mind, that, you know, that this is something that the adults in their lives are banning. And I mean, I guess some, you know, you kind of, you know, look at it two ways. One, you could rebel against authority and say, I'm going to use it more than ever somehow. Or two, do you think there's any chance that some kids would think, huh, maybe this isn't good for me? Or is that just sort of like a ridiculous thing to think?
I don't think many kids are thinking about it, say, when they're 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. By the time they get in the middle schools, they're certainly talking about it. There's enough evidence. Mm-hmm. Teachers are talking about
it. They can read about it online.
Yep. And if the school implements a ban, one of the things they'll be telling them is because spending all that time isn't good for you, and here's what it does, right? Mm-hmm. Now, there's going to be a huge difference in within different families. What are the parents saying, and are the parents at home putting any restrictions on? But I certainly know, say, among my college students that most of them are really concerned about how they limit their time on their digital devices and on things like YouTube Shorts, that sort of thing, which tend to be highly addictive. The problem is many of them have already developed these addictive habits that are very hard to break. And the other thing they find that's really tough is that they're living in a social environment in which people are just much more isolated. So when I compare, for example, when I went to college, there were all kinds of social groups, and there was, you know, kids were hanging out because you're bored otherwise. So you, mm-hmm. you go and you, so there's all these social events taking place, and there just isn't that rich variety and wealth of social opportunity that there used to be. It's harder for young people now who've developed these kind of addictive habits to break out of it, because they're trying to break out of it into a kind of an impoverished social environment.
It's really the only life they've known, right? I mean, you said when did smartphones come on the scene? You know, 15 years ago, just to pick a round number. Well, if you're 20 years old, I mean, that's really all that you remember. And it is, and you know, both of us are certainly, we remember life before smartphones. I don't know if that makes us, though, more immune from their harms. I mean, obviously, the reason we're focusing today on phones in the classroom is that, you know, we have a lot more as a society levers to pull about how to control behavior of children. But I certainly think a lot of these things that you're talking about, people being more insular, people interacting with like people in real life, are all things that all adults and young people are doing less of. Am I right that the reason we're having these conversations about kids are, one, we want to break the habit earlier if we can, and two, it's much easier to like regulate them.
But it's more of a crisis for kids because it affects us, of
yeah.
course. I've noticed a decreased attention span because I spend a lot of my day on screens. Mm-hmm. And partly that's what my work requires. But also it's easier to come home and if I'm tired, watch something on Netflix, that sort of thing. It's easier to do that than read a book or go out to some event if I'm tired. And that might have been something I would do in previous years. But it's easier to be engaged and entertained at home than it ever has been. That's a concern I have about myself, and I think most adults either should or do have that concern.
And
for kids, it's different, though.
Okay,
and that's a key thing because their brains are developing, and especially kids who are on digital devices at really young ages. And you just go to the grocery store, you will see 3-year-olds who are riding in a cart while the parent is shopping and the kid is on a phone or an iPad, and they're playing a game or they're watching videos. There's all kinds of things they aren't learning because they're not socializing with other people. they're not participating in this activity that like helping their parent shop, which can be really annoying when they're that age because they aren't really any help. But that's really important for them to learn like these skills of how to engage with the real world. And then you amplify that during like all the hours during all of childhood in which they're not developing the neural networks. That doesn't come back. I mean, they might recover some of that later on, but that is permanent damage that's being done. And this is why it's really important at the earliest ages to limit screen time. Schools can only do so much. They can only limit screen time, you know, during that school day, right?
And one phrase that I know comes up a lot when you read about this topic are what folks call lean back or lean forward experiences online. And much of what we do on our devices, whether it's, like you said, Netflix, TikTok, just sort of scrolling through endless feeds, is lean back. I mean, you're not interacting with this in any significant way. It's just sort of either a way to pass time, be entertained. And like, that's not entirely bad, but it shouldn't be all we do. There are, though, like what experts call lean forward experiences where you are interacting more. And I think that makes it tough in some ways for educators because they're trying to interact with kids in ways that interest them and grab their attention. And I think intuitively educators think, well, if I can do that digitally, that's going to somehow grab their attention more quickly than if I do it on a old-fashioned blackboard. But if you are doing it in ways that's making them think, making them interact, making them, you know, kind of make decisions about things that they see, respond to things that they see, to me that feels quite a bit different than just sitting back, zoning out, and paying sort of attention to what's there.
This is really problematic in school settings that say want to use some platform like YouTube to give access to all kinds of educational materials that might really promote learning. And there's some amazing stuff on YouTube that you can get like both current videos that explain things that like really in depth and do it well. And yet what it keeps pushing you to is the lean back experience, because that's what becomes highly addictive and that's what you can just push and watch over and over. And so once you open the box, whatever the intention is, doesn't matter really how much you want students to use it for the lean in purpose, it's going to default to the passive experience. And this is the problem. And we can see it in our own lives. And I will do this. I will be researching something and I'll come across, whether it's news stories or websites, it's a YouTube video about something that I'm trying to learn, and I'm taking notes, I'm getting information about it. And then I'll click something adjacent or the next thing that pops up, and it's just entertainment. It's just fluff. And it's highly engaging, right? And it becomes very easy then to waste, you know, 30 minutes or an hour just going through this stuff without really, if you don't have the discipline to say, I'm going to push that away and focus on the stuff that takes energy to engage. So this is the thing is, the leaning experience you're talking about is work, mm-hmm. right? And we're kind of programmed to avoid work. I mean, work is hard, but it's also what ends up making life rewarding. Like if you're not progressing somehow in your life quickly becomes not meaningful. And that's a real problem especially for students right now.
And I think since schools have existed, that their main purpose is to prepare students for adulthood and for careers and for the times when they're out of school. And it makes me wonder that should we look at that a lot differently than maybe we did 20 years ago, because the things that you talked about earlier, these interpersonal skills, these feeling like you belong, feeling, making others feel like they belong, kind of building these communities, are those things that you think schools should be spending more time on? And of course, I don't think either of us believe that you should do that at the, you know, while taking away entire courses, but maybe reframe those courses in ways where you're teaching them to promote these sort of secondary soft skills as well. I'm old enough, and I'm sure you are too, to remember sitting in, whether it was a science class or maybe a social studies class when we were kids, with film strips, right? And for those who are listening who don't know what a film strip is, you sort of had these still images that were often on a kind of a slide projector sort of a thing. And then there would be a narration, and then there would be a beep, and then you'd advance to the next image, and there'd be explanation about the next image. And this could be anything, again, from how caterpillars become butterflies to how Calvin Coolidge served in the White House, all sorts of topics. But those I think teachers used those back then because it was just like a different way to present the curriculum in ways they thought or hoped would be more engaging. Now I wonder, and I'm not saying we should go back to film strips, that seems like a bad idea, but do you think as teachers are describing how to present their lessons, that they should be thinking a lot more about how to undigitize these experiences and to make them kind of how we taught even maybe before you and I were in school, before we even had things like film strips? Because it would be unusual for a kid at age 15 to not know how a smartphone works or not be able to find something on YouTube. Those don't seem like skills that schools need to spend much time teaching. So do you think teachers should be thinking about how they can make their classrooms as analog as possible?
Yes. Because if you look at overall what are our students having trouble with, it's not navigating the digital world. Most of them are doing that much better than the teachers are. And mm-hmm. So what are the teachers? They're not actually teaching them how to prepare for the digital future. They're already learning that, and they're picking it up very quickly. What they're having trouble with is, say, social interaction. And that's not digital. That's person to person. That's face to face. That's standard communication, basic handwriting, for example. And then being able to create something by hand, make it so. I think art classes are incredibly important. Learning how to take something from intention, from an idea, and produce it in the physical world. You know, like, so I think a lot of the stuff that we experienced when we were in school, shop class and home ec and that sort of thing, I think these are incredibly important. And when we look at the deficit in like practical skills that many of our students have, and you're thinking, well, what's the point of school? It's to prepare you for all of life, right? It's not just to administer tests and to make sure that you're doing better on tests. It's to prepare you for life. And if that's the case, then you look at, okay, so what do our young people really need to flourish in life? Well, they're going to need to communicate. They're going to need to know how to make things, how to navigate the physical world. All of those things we should be preparing them for.
Well, you mentioned something that I want to kind of spend another minute on. But you were talking about all these things or courses or topics that schools have kind of let fall by the wayside and should bring back. A lot of that list made sense to me. The one, and I'll admit that I have a kind of a bias here because I would be terrible at it and probably was not great, but am now legitimately terrible at, is handwriting or cursive. And that is something you do hear about periodically, that a certain school district or even maybe an occasional state adds back into the curriculum after it has been removed for quite some time. You think that's a good switch to bring things like handwriting and the Palmer method back?
I don't know about the Palmer method, but certainly something like handwriting, like the ability to put your thoughts down on paper and to do it physically.
Versus typing.
And like we've got plenty of research on this, like how much of an aid it is being able to take notes, how much of an aid that is to recall. That's incredibly important. And so we've got enough research on why that's important. We should absolutely be doing it. And so I think like basic kind of handwriting, whether that's cursive or printing, and doing it in a way that's intelligible to other people.
I would argue for me, sometimes it's not intelligible to myself, actually.
Right. But legibility used to be something that we were graded on, right? Mm-hmm. If the teacher couldn't read it, you got a big red mark. And like that sort of thing, I think, is important. It's all of this, like, how do I translate what's going on in my head into a format where it's intelligible to others that allows me to interact productively with others in the world? And that goes from communication, it goes to speaking, to standing up and giving a presentation before other people. It's explaining things one-on-one. It's writing things down and taking notes. And it's also like painting, making music, like all the things that we consider the arts to be useful for. All of this, like the various forms in which we have human interaction that makes our intentions, our interior world, translate to the exterior world. All of this is very important. And what we have right now, when that lean back, I think what you would call mm-hmm. that experience of the passive consumption, keeps everything internal, right?
Yeah.
And this is what is so harmful. And we have a significant increase in what we call depressive attitudes among students, where they say, my life is useless, I don't mean anything, or I don't count for anything. That's those sorts of attitudes. If you can't express yourself in some way into the actual world, this is what results. And so we ought to be helping our students make their lives meaningful in these ways.
It would seem, though, that like if you just got done saying the most important thing we could be teaching our kids today is how to, just to pick a topic at random, know advanced math better. You know, that might not be like fun for everybody, but there's like something that exists where you could, if you poured like a ton of resources and made that the number one priority in education today to improve math literacy, like, I think there's people who know how to do that, and we could probably make progress on that if that was, like, extremely important. I don't know, though, if we have if most educators, and I'll ask, you're an educator, so you'll know better than me, but have a real sense of how to do what you just described, of how to make young people better at building these relationships and to appreciate the analog world more than the digital world. In some ways, to me, that seems like a tougher task than just saying, we're going to concentrate more on doing algebraic equations. That this seems...
Well, of course it's a tougher task.
But, you think it's possible?
Yeah, but I think we're talking now about a transformation, not just of schools, I think you like the school expectations, but also our schools of education, the universities, and what we're preparing teachers to do. One of the things is we've made teaching into, in some ways, I would say, an impoverished profession, where it's been so focused on test scores and just administering the tests and teaching to the test, and it's similar to what has happened in some cases in healthcare, where healthcare has been about doing procedures and running tests and addressing health outcomes after they've been, and not really focusing on health.
Sick care versus health care.
Versus health care. And what do we want a health care system to do? We want it to improve people's health. Well, that's a very different approach than just diagnosing something and prescribing something. And this is kind of what's happened with our schools, too, is that when we say we're just about administering the tests, and we can say make this goal, like we want to improve math scores. Well, there are ways to do it, and I think, and this is what kind of educational systems have specialized in, is figuring out strategies for improving scores. And it's a really bad approach because we're not asking the case, like, what makes a life meaningful? What makes human beings flourish in their lives, and how do we prepare people for a flourishing life? And this is something that then where schools can do part of this, but schools have to be interactive with the broader community in a way which they used to be very well. And I think some schools still do a pretty good job of it, but many schools don't.
Before we close on this topic, one thing I just wanted to bring up is, in most places across this country, not everywhere, but most places across this country have the same general school calendar that you and I grew up with, is that, you know, the school year begins on or around Labor Day and ends on or around Memorial Day, which means you have about 3 months of free time for educators, but also for students. And, you know, historically, the reason for that is long outdated, but that was because kids were needed to help with, you know, growing vegetables and all sorts of agricultural needs that have mostly passed us by. It also, though, makes me think, you know, when I was a kid, and I was not, compared to a lot of my peers, I was not the most outdoor, active, explore, you know, you hear kids that, oh, the sun would come up and I'd leave the house on my bike and not come back until sunset. I mean, maybe I did that sometimes. That's not what I did every day. But that was some of my summer, and there are certainly a lot of kids that had a summer that was very different than their the rest of the year. They were hanging out with their friends more, going on little adventures around their neighborhood, doing all sorts of different creative things. And my sense is that the schools now that still have that calendar, that's those summer that summertime off seems to probably be less different. I mean, yes, you're not in school, but they're probably spending as much, if not more time in front of screens than they do during the school year. And I just wonder, I mean, I think you agree with that, but I also wonder if that's even yet another reason to do something that I think has been important for a long time now, is that we just need to blow up the existing school calendar. And I think the best way to reinforce some of the messages that you just got done talking about is make that a 12-month effort, not just a 9-month effort, with obviously some intentional time off during that 12-month period. I don't know what your thoughts are on year-round school, but I just can't help but think that would help that process a bit.
I think it depends on the school and what's going on in school. So if it's a school that is serious about helping students learn more about how to engage in social interaction, how to engage with the real world, not just putting them on screens. But there's a lot of schools where they're spending a lot of time on screens at the schools that haven't done cell phone bans, schools that are using Chromebooks, for example, and where they have access to YouTube, and they're spending a lot of time watching YouTube shorts like that. Then I don't see what is the difference between them spending year round in school or at home where they're doing the same thing. The other thing you have to look at is that the effects on that 3 month, approximately 3 month break for kids is going to be a lot different depending on the family which the kid is going into. Like, some of them are going to have some really rich, wonderful experiences during that time, and others, as you point out, are just going to spend the whole time on screens, and they're going to have a real regression in their learning. I kind of saw this past weekend. I was in an event there's an event that took place all day, and the next morning there was a number of volunteers that were helping to clean up the venue. It was for about 2 or 3 hours. There was a few adults, and then some of the adults had kids. There was one mother who had a daughter who was, say, 9 or 10 years old, and she was helping out. This little girl was interacting with the adults, and she was being given responsibility. You know, like she had to walk around the venue and pick up all the empty pop cans that were lying about, and if they were half full, like to empty them out somewhere and then put them in a bag. And she was doing all this, and then she was rearranging some chairs. She had a friend whose mother had wanted her daughter to just kind of stay out of the way. So she'd given her phone, and she just went in another room, spent the whole 2 hours by herself, I assume scrolling videos or something. I have no idea what she was
staying
doing.
Staying out of trouble, obviously,
she
which
was
is,
staying out of trouble. The mom was interacting with the other mom, but she wasn't helping out. And this little girl, at the end of it, I remember this one little girl came up to the other one and said, "Look at what we did." And she was all proud of her help in accomplishing something because they had transformed this venue from a big mess into something that was nice and clean and orderly, and she had been a part of it. It probably wouldn't have been any harder to do it without her help, but it was really important for her. And what I would predict is those two girls are going to have very different summer experiences, right? And I think for that first one, the one who was helping out at that time, probably her mother is going to make sure that all summer long she was doing household tasks. They're probably going to do things together as a family, and she's going to have a really rich experience, and it's going to be good for her to have that break from school. For the other one, she would probably be better off being in school during the summer months because at least then she would have some social interaction and be doing something meaningful if it's a halfway decent school. We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. Scott, what's your question for me?
So, Rick, we have an old lawnmower that we bought on clearance about 15 years ago from Kmart. And this, it's nothing special. It works. And we have a small yard, and it's fine, right? And our neighbor recently asked if he could borrow our mower because it's broken. While using it, our neighbor accidentally runs over a chunk of concrete in his yard, and now the mower won't start. Our neighbor feels bad about this, and he has offered to pay to repair or replace the mower. However, it was clearly his mistake, but, I mean, it wasn't intentional. On the other hand, the mower was old, and there's a good chance it didn't have much life left anyway. If you were in my situation, which I should tell you is mostly hypothetical, but we'll get to that in a second, what would you do?
I think you should take it back to Kmart and get it fixed.
That seems like a bad choice.
Okay.
Although, oddly, the Kmart building is it less than a mile from my house and still standing?
It's about ready to be demolished.
It's about
ready,
but I guess I could stand there and knock on the door and see if anybody's inside.
Yeah. If it's a 15-year-old mower, you probably reached the lifespan. And if it wasn't a really good mower,
it was not.
And
it probably has been if it's lasted this long. But it was a cheap mower.
But I'm assuming you also aren't the person who's been really meticulous about changing the oil every year.
So it's funny you mentioned that. Somebody we both know, every early spring, he would chat and say, "Well, I'm going to be a few minutes late into work today. Oh, why is that? Well, I have to drop off the mower for the annual oil change and tune-up." And I thought to myself every year, oh, should we be doing that? But we never did. So like maybe 3 years ago, we actually did bring it in for like its first ever oil change and tune-up. It seemed like no better or worse.
Did you ever check the oil and add more oil to it?
I don't know how to do that. Honestly, if you would have asked me if before this, do mowers take oil? I would have been like, I don't know, maybe.
So in that case, Scott, I would say, you got more years out of that mower than you deserved. And so you should just tell your friend, oh, that moored's at the end of its lifespan anyway. Don't worry about it. You know, just saying it's a 15-year-old mower that's really been maintained well, mm-hmm. and if you're meticulous about it, and it's all in good shape.
And maybe it was like a good brand and a high expense. Right. And this one was like a brand, I won't mention the brand, but it was like, I think the mower was like on clearance for like $125, $150 at the time.
Yeah, and he probably bent the shaft or something, yeah, you know, yeah. like hitting this concrete. If it's in prime working condition, you've really taken care of it.
That's another thing. Or it's just a year old.
That's another thing. And then I think, you know, somebody, you hit a block of concrete, yeah. When you borrow something, you take responsibility for due care. I mean, if it you just couldn't get it started, or you're just using it, nothing happens, but it dies for some reason, that's another thing. You hit a block of concrete with your mower, you're not really paying attention. That's your fault as the borrower.
Mm-hmm.
But in your case, with that old of a mower, I would say, oh, just look at it as a good opportunity to get a new one.
And so what's really happened is that we do have a neighbor who we don't know well. He's not lived there long. And Travis actually has gotten to know him a little better than I have. And he asked Travis if he could borrow our mower because his is not working. And he has, I think, an electric mower, and he learned that the battery is – he needs a new battery.
Oh, he didn't run over a big rock with his own mower and then had to borrow yours and then did the same thing.
No, his was just like – I don't know how the electric mower – obviously, this is not an area I know a lot about, but apparently his mower needed like a new battery or charger or something, so he was going to borrow ours. And it's funny, as we record this, Travis told me like almost a week ago, oh, so-and-so next door needs to borrow our mower, just so you know if he knocks on the door and you happen to be home, it's fine. Oh, great. That's no problem. That's no problem. But he still hasn't yet. So I don't – and I don't know why that is. I don't really care. I looked at his yard the other day. It doesn't really even seem to be needing to be mowed. So who knows, right? I don't know. But it got me thinking that had he borrowed it and had something like this happen, what would the response be? And I'm generally on your side. I think – two things. One, we've gotten more than our money's worth out of this mower over. I mean, it's like, you know, if my memory's about right, this has cost us about $10 a year to have a mower. And we have a small yard, but again, it's gotten plenty of use. But it also, then you can also easily, like you started to do, flip this around. And what would you do if you were, you know, borrowing someone's old mower and you did something to kind of make it seize up? I would feel like pretty guilty about that, and especially when it's someone who you know you're going to like see on a sort of regular basis, and you don't want to like cause, you know, hard feelings about something that's a relatively small stakes item. So if it were the other way around, I would, if I got the sense that someone was sort of taking the approach you were of, hey, this was an old mower, you know, it was not top of the line even the day we bought it, this is a good excuse for us to get another one. My response, if I was the one who had been using it when it broke, would be like, well, that's all well and good, but here's like $50 toward your purchase of a new mower, and you know, or do $50 you can do with what you'd like, but here you go. And that's, I guess, maybe the way I would approach it, especially if the person's like, no, don't worry about it. I would feel like some obligation to like fund a little bit of the purchase.
Yeah, if you were the borrower.
Yeah, if I were the borrower. Yeah, yeah. Would I expect that from him? I mean, it would be fine, but I tend to agree with you, is that this has been a good machine for us and has served us well, and maybe it's time to move on.
And a good question to ask for you, you know, as the owner of it, to ask is, what would you do if the mower had failed, or if you'd hit a big rock or something and it wasn't working?
Or the winter's over happened, and I just can't start it.
Would you take it in to get it repaired,
yeah,
or would you replace it? And I'm guessing at 15 years old, it hasn't been really well maintained anyway, you would probably just replace it at this point.
I think you're right.
And so then I would say that's what you should tell your neighbor, is just say, look, we were ready to replace this mower anyway.
Yeah, this is sort of on a month-to-month lease at this point.
Right, yeah. This sort of thing happens a lot when, like, somebody borrows a car, and it's a like a used car, and a big question that comes up is, did you do something to cause the failure, or did it just happen? So, like, did the water pump go out, and it was going to go out no matter who was driving it? Well, then the owner should just replace the water pump. You don't ask the person who borrowed the vehicle for a day to replace the water pump because they happen to be driving it on the day that it went out, right? But if they like they drive over a curb and you've got damage to your front end, that's their fault. They should be replacing it, right?
So can I use the last couple minutes of our show to make a confession?
Go ahead. So I'm interested in hearing this.
So many, many years ago, and I've lost touch with everybody in the story who was involved. I was in my early 20s, and I, like a lot of people at that age, I had a series of kind of junky cars. And I think it was one of the periods in my life where maybe my car was in the shop or I was between cars. I'm not sure. And a friend of mine had an old, even then, old Volkswagen Beetle. This was like the original ones that were out in, I guess, what, 60s and 70s? I don't even know. And he's like, hey, and he let me borrow. And I think it was just like a day, again, recollection's sort of sketchy. And it was not in the best of shape. It was, you know, it was kind of rusty. And I don't know if those had reputations for being long-lasting vehicles. I don't even know. But, and it was summertime. And I just drove it. I just drove it to the store or something really simple. And I was just getting out of the vehicle and doing nothing I've done a million other times. And as I was getting out, I pressed my foot, the tip of my foot went through the floorboard because the floorboard was so rusty. And I'm like, oh, that seems bad. And I'm like, then I looked and I could see I had created a little hole in the bottom. So I just rearranged the floor mats in such a way that I would hope that he never noticed. And I think the next day or two gave the car back and never said anything. That was probably not the right thing to do, but it was awfully rusty at the time.
Yeah, you should have said something. but I would still say, but it's not your fault. I mean, if it's so rusty that a little bit of weight, a little bit of pressure from the toe of your foot can poke a hole through it. You didn't cause that to happen. But then once it does happen, you want to tell the friend because then it's a safety issue.
Yeah. Well, this was probably in 1993, if I had to guess. So although I've lost touch with this friend, I'm even more confident that this car is no longer on the road causing a safety issue. So hopefully the statute of limitations on this has passed.
Yeah, I had a friend who had a Volkswagen Beetle. This was in the early 90s and early 80s, and her foot went through the floorboard. It was completely rusted out.
So this is maybe a problem with these vehicles. Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah, and she ended up taking a highway sign because they're a really good corrosion-proof metal. It was an old highway sign that she had gotten somewhere. Was able to cut it out towards the dimensions of the floorboard on the driver's side and just placed it down there and then was able to get another couple of years out of that car. But it was a different problem in the northern states that with a lot of salt on the roads.
Well, as a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, especially if you are listening right now in a Volkswagen Beetle. And also be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thanks for listening.